The Coast 89.7 is proud to present the latest edition of our radio documentary series produced with the financial support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. And now, The Story of Home with your host, Donnie Antle.
Welcome to The Story of Home. I'm Donnie Antle. In this episode, we take a closer look on the role of religion in the day-to-day life of Cape Breton and visit some of the houses of worship in our community. Religion has always been a part of the Cape Breton experience. From the Mi'kmaq who converted to Catholicism to cement their bonds with the French, to the Irish and Scottish Catholics who came here in part to escape persecution. The growth of industrial Cape Breton attracted people of all faiths, looking for opportunity and a fresh start. At the turn of the century, the first Jewish families arrived from Eastern Europe. Martin Chernin is the president of the Temple Sons of Israel.
Well, I think the first synagogue was established in Glace Bay, and that was over 100 years ago. We had a 100th anniversary in Glace Bay, I forget, maybe 5 or 6 years ago or 10 years ago, so that was over 100 years ago, 110 years ago or more. Also one in New Waterford and Whitney Pier, and Sydney was the last one.
Stephen Nathanson is a historian. He has kept immaculate records of Cape Breton's Jewish community.
What would happen is wherever the boats got, like sometimes the boats would come into New York and then they would come from New York this way if they particularly had family here, okay? I had a relative, one of the women, come into North Sydney, another one into Lewisburg. These were important ports in the early 1900s, okay? Or late 1800s. Lewisburg, Gabarus, I mean, nobody would believe Gabarus, okay? But this is what would happen. And then, for example, my grandfather would probably be the best example. Israel was in New York. He's 15 years old. He's with Morris Lachansky, who's a relative. He's with the Greens, a relative. Max Nathanson is there, which is Norris's grandfather. And who shows up but Hyman Davidson? Now, Hyman Davidson is related to all of them, too. He's in New York. He's already has a store on 61 Prince Street. That's the corner of Prince and George, okay? Clothing store, and he's there buying. And he's trying to talk the boys into coming because they're making $2 a week if they're working. And the steel plant is booming and whatever, okay? Finally, that's 1895. In 1898, Israel Nathanson comes to Cape Breton. 3 months later, Lachansky comes. Then the Greens. Max doesn't show up till 1903 because he gets married, and the three boys, Nate and the doctors and the Annie, are born here, okay? But it's interesting to see these people coming. And some of them stay, and some of them don't. But they succeed, the ones that stay in most cases here.
The community needed places to worship, so they chipped in to build synagogues starting in Glace Bay.
The 1902, they started 1901. Okay, I have in the synagogue on display, I have the newspaper article on it. Okay, it says 1902, but they started actually in 1901 to build it. Okay, that was community money. Okay, everybody would. It was 50 cents or $5 or $500 they gave. The Tama Torah in Glace Bay, I don't think, cost more than $16,000 to build. Okay? It was scrap wood they were using in those days. Okay? It was that. New Waterford was built. New Waterford was built in 1922. Sydney, the pier, was 1913. They purchased the land, laid the cornerstone, and had services that year. Okay, Sydney is an interesting thing. In 1914, the women, because a lot of the families are moving out of the period uptown, basically, to what I call Sydney proper, okay? Cottage Road, Whitney Avenue, Park Street, Brooklyn Street, that type of thing, okay? So anyway, they decided they should have a women's organization. The women in the pier have an organization called the Daughters of Jacob. So they came up here and they're going to have what today would be known as the Sisterhood, Daughters of Israel, in those days. The men didn't want to be outdone, so in 1915 they decided to have a meeting and they formed the Temple Sons of Israel. Okay? 1916, they bought the Baptist Church, which was Bethany Baptist Church. Actually, this year, the Heritage Church is going to be 100 years old, and Bethany became, and another church, on, I believe, Lingang Road, joined together to create that Heritage Church, okay? And they bought the church and remodeled it.
The people who contributed to the temple's construction weren't wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. In the early years, many of them made a living peddling various goods across the island.
They started. Some of them would have enough money to open a store, but most of them came and peddled. Some of them peddled in town, some of them went out. For example, you have my grandfather, Israel Nathanson, peddled from Sydney up to, Escazone, and up to Castle Bay, Padec, Inganish, and so on, okay? Followed by the name of Sam Freed. Sam peddled, but he also had a store in Homeville. And in Glace Bay, his brother Maxim owned King Botley. Okay? You had Moses Spinner. That's the start of Spinner's Menswear. He peddled in Bedeck out of his house. Didn't even have a license until Nate was born, okay? You had Morris Lachansky. Morris came, like I said, in 1898, started as a peddler, then opened up a store just down from my grandfather, and he brought in Dave Epstein, who was also a riddle. Dave ended up marrying Lachansky's daughter, which would meet them first cousins, okay? Max Nathanson came, peddled fish for a while. Didn't like that. Opened up an ice cream parlor where Moravs are today, okay? Israel Simon is somebody, that'd be Dr. Simon from Grace Bay. His father started in Port Morin with peddling, but he also had a store. After the First World War, he moved that store to Birch Grove, okay, and still peddled.
Well, the most important thing for them when they came here is they wanted their children to be educated, and that's how it all started. My grandfather, Dom, you know, first eldest in the family was my Aunt Bella, but then came second, Dr. Avey. And my grandfather wanted him to become a professional. And the biggest aim for all of these Jewish families was get their children educated at university. And same on the Chernin side, my Uncle Solly, Dad's brother, Dad went to Dal, got his Bachelor of Commerce, and then he had to go overseas for the war. And my Uncle Saul became a dentist. And so I'm just talking about my own family, but you can go on and on and on. There's numerous, all the same, because it's evident that most of them got very well educated and went to bigger cities and bigger areas.
Peddling came to grocery stores, general stores, butchers, fruit and vegetable stores, clothing stores, stationery stores, which Norris's his father got into, grocery wholesale, which my grandfather got into, pool rooms, bowling alleys. My grandfather in New Waterford, one of his businesses was a bowling alley, okay? Ice cream parlors, furniture stores, building supplies, hardware stores, theaters like the Russell Theater and the Savoy. There were pop plants, such as Global Manufacturing, King, Mayflower, Sunshine, and Isle Royale Beverages was the last one, which would have been Clark Kaplan, where Sweeney's was up there. And then you had ship supplies, which were in Newman Dubinsky in the pier, which is the business still there today. You had fish plants, and those were like the Goldmans in Glace Bay, or in Glace Bay were the Lipkises, and they had a fish plant in Lingan. Corner stores. And this is where you get women in, like Yetta Land. She had 10 kids, had a little grocery store up on Lingang Road. All those kids got educated. Some of them were doctors and whatever, okay? Plumbing and heating. You had one other example with Island Distributors today with Curtis and Martin and Jerry down there. And then they had hay and feed stores hosted. My grandfather's hay and feed store was at 16 Crossing in New Waterford. Doctors like Abe and his brother Lewis, mm-hmm. and a pair, but there were others like Dr. Leith and so on. You had lawyers, like Judge Dubinsky was a judge, but he was a lawyer beforehand. Hilroy Nathanson, lawyer-judge. Frank Elman, Mo Rosenblum, okay? You had some that became mayors, like my cousin Danny Nathanson of New Waterford. Senators, like Marshall from Grace Bay. Pinky Gong, member of parliament. Radio business. Radio store was the first thing that Nathaniel opened, okay? That money came from my grandfather Israel, because they didn't have the money, okay? Then the radio station, because he needed voices, okay? Then the TV station. Then you had the dairies, Modern City Dairy, that'd be Mr. Hirsch, okay? Yeah. And Spices in Glace Bay.
If you went down Charlotte Street in the late 50s, early 60s, you had Dave Epstein clothing. You had, and in New Waterford, his brother Benny Epstein had clothing. Then the Schwartzes had clothing in New Waterford. And Rose Schwartz's son, Harold, actually, Jacobson's, Tweedy Hickory. There was Spinner's. There was Sherman's menswear. Then the Lebetsky's from Glace Bay, furniture stores in Sydney and Glace Bay, Bunnell and Lebetsky's. They were a lot of the second generation Jews that came here, got heavily involved in the retail clothing business too.
As the Jewish community grew and established itself on Cape Breton, members of the community rose to prominent positions. Percy Gaum, more commonly called Pinky, would run for office in the 50s in the newly created provincial riding of Cape Breton Nova. He'd become the first Jewish MLA in Nova Scotia and go on to serve his constituents for 14 years. Pinky served in the Second World War and spent time as a POW. So did Stephen Nathanson's father.
My father was on his, I think, 23rd mission, or first, we're not sure. He never talked about it. He got shot down. He was a rear gunner. Lucky he wasn't killed. He ended up in a tree. The Germans got him. They marched him into camp, and Dad would hear said, tell us, all you could hear was, "Hi, Nate! Hi, Nate! Hi, Nate!" They're all from Cape Breton. There was Pinky and Mike Laffin and all the rest of them from North Sydney, New Waterford, whatever. Okay, it was like going home week, okay? Pinky was in camp a couple of months before my father was there. Now, one thing about Pinky didn't like fish, okay? Dad would eat, give him the canned meat. Dad would eat the fish, Pinky would eat the meat. He was ready to kill him half the time. Because Pinky, all he wanted to do was fight with people. That was the way Pinky was, okay? Pinky wanted a pension or an increase in pension. And I was at the same meeting. Mother was there. I was at the Holiday Inn years ago. And Mike Wally was there, so he was city solicitor, and those things. They're all in the same camp, okay? Everybody was there, Mike laughing and so on. And I go in, and we're having a trouble with the government, and they're not giving in. I said, good. By the time Pinky finishes with you, you're not going to like it. Anyway, we get outside. Nobody's leaving. We're waiting for Pinky to go. You can hear him through the big bay doors, screaming and hollering, calling him everything.
Another prominent Jewish citizen contributed to the growth of Cape Breton's local media by founding the radio and television station that first gave Cape Breton a voice. His name was Nate Nathanson, and the station he founded was CJCB.
There's all kinds of stories, okay? What I was told by my father, that his father lent him the money. Okay, he worked, when he came out of school in 1908, he graduated in 1908 from Sydney Academy. And the principal states he wished he still had Nate because, the debating club would win for fun, okay? He started in 1908 working on the International Peers,
yeah.
Okay? Moved from there to purchasing, okay? Then they had the ice cream parlor and everything, and now he moves, I guess he didn't like what he was doing, he moved uptown and opened up where the radio store is today, or the CJCB is. Sell radios. Then he realized they couldn't only pick things up at night. So that's when he opened up started the radio. And I mean, laying out there on, McLeod's Hill is the antenna for that setup, okay? That's probably one of the oldest buildings out there, along with the McLeod's farm out there.
I can barely remember Nate Nathanson. I remember him, but he died years ago. But I knew his two sons, Norris and Marvin, very well. Marvin eventually moved to Halifax when the Nathansons sold out their TV operation to CTV. And I think he operated CTV for Atlantic Canada. Norris stayed here and they kept the radio station for a long time, actually. And then Norris, I think then they sold it to Halifax, Pace, I think, bought that. And Norris stayed for a while, but he got ill and passed away. His wife, Reva, is still living, lives in Toronto now, because her daughter lives up there. But they were certainly the leaders in radio and television, certainly, not only in Cape Breton. I mean, Cape Breton, they were all of it, because I think, Nate Nathanson had the first radio station in Cape Breton and the first television station. And so they were pretty well a legend here in Cape Breton.
Nowadays, the once thriving Jewish community is in decline. Only one synagogue remains, the Temple Sons of Israel.
At one time, there were about 2,000 Jews in Cape Breton in the early 50s. And now there's, I think our membership of the synagogue is 45 people, including widows, widowers.
By 1944-45, we're starting to go down, 869. In 2015, we have less than 80 Jewish families, 80 Jewish people on this island, okay? And we only have one synagogue left, mm-hmm. which is the one built in 1916, okay? Today, we're probably down into the 60s, if not more. And people move, and we overflow in the summertime when everybody comes back for their bungalows. Okay, it's what happened was that some of the people stayed and were successful. This is first generation born, and others like the GOM doctors, they became first generation born. They succeeded and they stayed here to do it. If you go to Glace Bay and the Sterling, you have the Mendelssohn boys, Daniel and Sammy. They succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. Okay? Some of them, the rest, pack up and leave. Third generation, which I am, I'm second generation. Curtis Carroll, his brother Martin and Jerry, they're here. But how many? Okay? Martin Chernin, second generation born. Okay? They made a success, but the rest of them left. And I think in a lot of cases, the families wanted them to move on to a better society, like Toronto or Vancouver or whatever, because that's where most of them went, or Winnipeg or whatever. But it killed off and there were no new people coming, very few over the years. Doctors for the hospital, college out here, and then they pack up and they leave. And we're brand. There's only two young children here, the Strong boys in New Waterford, Dr. Strong's sons. One just had a bar mitzvah, the next one will be coming up.
Well, I think the decline was a lot of the second generation Jews that came. Their children went to university. They got involved in medicine, dentistry, law. And they moved off to bigger Jewish communities like Halifax, Toronto, Boston. I mean, I had, I think on the Chernin side, just first cousins, I think there was 18 of us. And on the GOM side, there was 9. So that's 27 first cousins. There's 2 left in Cape Breton, myself and my cousin Mark. So 25 of them moved away. As they say, that the Jewish population of Cape Breton is now, and the biggest is in Toronto. There's more Cape Bretoners in Toronto than there are here, Jews in Toronto than there are here.
It's hard to believe that this went from this. I mean, I can remember going to Waterford, and just about every store on the main street was Jewish. The Pier, Commercial Street in Glace Bay, mm-hmm. Okay, Victoria Road. Both sides of the road. The houses are on one side and the business are on the other, you know? It's hard to see this go.
Before we move on from the synagogue, I want to share a story that Stephen Nathanson was kind enough to share with me.
When I was growing up, and it's one of the things I mentioned when I talked at the Old Sydney Society, I'm going to tell you a story. It's called The Rabbi, the Priest, the Chickens, and the Kids. The synagogue was here on the right-hand side if you went in the yard, parking lot, and the Columbuses and their fence. this day, there's a bunch of, 20 kids, sitting, the older kids sitting on the picket fence, and the younger ones like myself, because I was only five, sitting on the lower ground, waiting for the rabbi. Why? The rabbi came out to cheer, and the rabbi acknowledged the kids. He was coming over to cut the heads off the chickens for the Jewish holiday. Okay? And what he would do is he'd cut the chicken's head, and he'd drop the chicken. Chicken would run, the kids would chase the chicken. This went on for a half hour, an hour. Kids are pooped. They couldn't chase another chicken if they didn't. Anyway, one of the kids, a little Christian boy, Catholic, he got to go to confession. Now, what a 10-year-old has to confess, I don't know. But anyway, he's going to confession and on Sunday, and the priest listens to him, and he's, by the way, Father, he says, when are we going to get the chickens and raise the Jews? And there's dead silence. And the priest said, what? He said, I was at the chicken races the other day. Now, this priest, luckily, was very friendly with Rabbi Goldstein. He said, look, I'll get back to you next week. Come for confession. I'll get enough. So he calls Rabbi Goldstein for a meeting. Goes to the rabbi the next day, and they have me. He says, now, Rabbi, you got to stop these chicken races. And the rabbi, what the dickens are you talking about? He says, I had this child, and he wants to have chickens. Then he said, I'm going to have to buy chickens, race these chickens. You know how dirty they are, clean up behind them, and race you. And the rabbi starts to laugh, and he explains to the priest what's happened. The priest is hysterical. He says, thank God. He says, you know, he says, Rabbi, he says, I have to clean up and have to race. And, you know, damn Protestants want to get into the act too, you know.
On Hankard Street in Whitney Pier stands a small white church. This church is the center of spiritual life for the black community of the pier. It opened its doors in the 1920s and continues to welcome parishioners to this day. Deacon Whitfield Best is the warden of St. Philip's African Orthodox Church. He says at first, black parishioners would attend either Trinity or St. Albans, until the priests made it known that they weren't welcome.
When they come from the West Indies, most of them were Church of England people, like, you know. And this is where, being they settled here in the pier, these churches were readily available to them. So this is where they went, you know.
How accepting were the Anglicans at St. Albans?
Well, this is why this church came here. It's because they were told, after a while, from the priest at the time from St. Albans, I don't know who he was. If I did, I wouldn't call his name, you know. So at the priest from St. Albans, he said to them, after there was an influx of West Indians coming to their church constantly, he said, I guess he got tired, and he said, you know, it's time that you people got your own church. And, you know, you're going to have to find some place to marry your women and bury your dead. We're not going to do it anymore for you. So this is how St. Philip's Church, you know, came here.
They'd create their own church. They needed a building in which to worship, and they found one in an unusual place.
This building here, as you see it today, was a vacant tool house in the coke ovens department. And my father was working there at the time, and he knew the building was vacant, so he went and asked the authorities, and they said, have you got any leaders down there? He said, yes, we have a couple of leaders down here. There was Dr. Calder at the time, and Lawyer Hamilton. They were the two leaders. So they went down and seen the officials down there, and they said, yes, we'll give you the building. It's vacant. We'll give it to you. But you got to move it yourself. You know, we're not going to help you move it. You got to move it yourselves. So they took it upon themselves. Yes, we'll take the building and we'll move it. And it was over here in the coke ovens department, over by Frederick Street, over that area. So he said they started to move it. He said everybody in the community, like, you know, that was interested, went down and they raised the building up, this building here, they raised it up, and they started rolling it on rollers. So I says, what kind of vehicles did you use? He said, you see these? That's what we used. We used our hands. Like, you know, we put ropes on it and we pulled. Archdeacon Philip, he was the priest here at the time. And he said he was the one in the front. And he had the ropes on his shoulders, just like a horse and wagon, and he was pulling. He was up front pulling, and the others were pushing and pulling and stuff like that. Men and women, you know, they're doing it. So I said, did it take very long to get it here? Yes, it took a while. He said it took a couple of weeks to get it here. And I said, when they got up the tracks on Frederick Street there, you know, where you come over the tracks, he said we had to stop and raise the building up in order to cross the tracks. Bed the tracks in, and as we were pulling it across the tracks, the wires were too low. He said Eastern Lightning Power Company wouldn't cut the wires for us, so we had to take the roof off the building. And he said that was a big feat. We had to take the roof off, and he said when we done that and start pulling it again, the side started to collapse on us. So he said we had to put ties into it. Right now, there's six ties in this building. You can't see them because this is a false roof here. There's six ties in here going from side to side to hold it together. And he said, when we got it here, in this spot right here, we just landed it here and left it. It was sort of in the ground, you know, and just left it there for quite a few years. We had our worships in here and things like that. He said, that's how and that's why the building became here, you know.
Even the bell has a link to the steel plant, as Deacon Best explains.
The bell was, that came from the steel plant also. And it was, because I say, I know a lot of these things because I used to ask a lot of questions. And I asked my father this. He said, my God, what do you want to know all this stuff for? I said, I don't know, I just like to know it, you know, which it was good, like, you know. So he said, that was one of the bells that was on the engines in the steel plant. And he said it was vacant. They weren't using it. So he said, I asked for it. What? He said, what are you going to do with that for our church? Oh, okay, take it. And they set a truck with it here, like, you know. So then they installed it up there, and it's the same bell that's up there today, like, you know, and it's still workable.
I asked Deacon Best how big the bell is. He used his hands to show me the bell is roughly 2 feet wide and 3 feet tall.
It's a bell. It's, well, it's about, I would say, about this large, all brass, you know, and it's heavy. You know, it's about, yeah, about this wide and about, perhaps about this high. And how they got it up there, I don't know, because that's quite a few hundred pounds to get it up there, yeah. So I guess they had some pretty strong boys there, too. You know?
They must have.
The new church building became a spiritual home for a new faith, the African Orthodox Church. This new faith has its roots in Greek Orthodox traditions, as Deacon Best explains.
I would say around 1920 and backwards, you know, when it started, probably 1919, something like that, like, you know, when the thing started. And as I said, this is how it came up. We had our first patriarch that was made. It was Alexander McGuire. You know, he was from the United States. And when he was made patriarch, We have a picture of the patriarch that made him a patriarch down the back there, Valette. He was of the Greek Orthodox, and he made McGuire a bishop. But he told him, he said, I can't give you the title of bishop of, you know, the Antioch or the Orthodox, because I'm not allowed to do that. So Bishop, you know, McGuire says, that's fine. I would sooner use African Orthodox because of my ethnic background. I would sooner use African Orthodox. So that's when the African Orthodox came to, like, you know, and he consecrated them, and then after that, McGuire consecrated more of them, like, you know, and it came up from there.
As the community grew, St. Philip's improved and grew as well. Father George A. Francis served as a priest for some 42 years. He made improvements to the building to make it more comfortable and usable for the community.
These railings were, yeah, they're recent and they were here in Father Francis' time, when he was here. That's his picture up there.
Okay. Yeah.
He came here in 1940, and he was the one instrumental in raising this building up and putting a foundation on it. Like, you know, he was very instrumental in doing that. And he was here for 42 years. He served here, you know, before he died. He died here, like, you know. Yeah. That's his daughter next to him there.
Father Francis's picture still hangs on the wall at St. Philip's, as does a picture of his daughter, Mary Ann Francis, the first Black Nova Scotian to serve as the province's lieutenant governor and the second woman to serve in that capacity. She was appointed in 2006 and served until 2012. Today, St. Philip's is the only African Orthodox parish in Canada. One of St. Philip's priests, Father Vincent Waterman, became Patriarch of the African Orthodox Church. Patriarch Vincent I would lead the church until his death earlier this year.
Here, I think, was around 1985 or something like that. I believe that was when he came around here, in 1985. See, he was married to Father Francis' daughter, like, you know, and when they got married, he came down here and they got married, and then they went back. And after, when Father Francis died, then they came back here, like, you know. And he became pastor of St. Philip's until about, I think it was 2 years ago, when they moved back to Halifax. Like, you know, he wasn't feeling all that well, so they wanted to move up with their daughter up there. So they moved back there, and then he...
And when did he become patriarch of the African Orthodox Church?
I would say it's possibly about 4 years ago, something like that. He became patriarch of the African Orthodox Church. That's about 4 years ago.
St. Philip's still stands on Hankard Street, still welcoming parishioners, and still stands as a testament to what the community can accomplish when people work together.
No, it was no outside help from it. No, it was the community as you got it there, that's destroyed, quite true. It was the community that was in here and around this area that made this happen, you know, yeah. Because so, when they were told, you know, you got to find some place to marry your women, bury your dead, so, well, we better make a move now and try to get something on our own. And this when this happened.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله حي على الصلاة
recent years, another faith has grown on Cape Breton, as more and more professionals, students, and people seeking new opportunities have arrived. The Islamic faith has grown. Dr. Arsalan Raza is the president of the Cape Breton Muslim Society.
That must be a long time ago. There are, remnants of Muslim heritage from the, families of Lebanese origin who came, maybe hundreds of years ago, and then you can see those traces in the names as well, like, Khattab and things like that. So you'll find those people there, like Abbas. But the process has started mainly maybe about, 15, 20 years ago when, the group of Muslims become active and wanted to, build a place for them. So it never been a big, huge population. There may be some people who are coming to the university as part of it. I could not really tell exactly when the first one will come, but I know that a number of people who are living here for, you know, 15, 20 years and maybe longer. But not in a, you know, true sense of community, because there are not that many people at that time. But, you know, in the maybe about 15 years ago, there was enough number of people who then decided to go ahead and start, you know, getting together for their, you know, Friday prayers, the congregation. And then in about, you know, about like 12, 13 years ago, they hired a small place, like rented a small, you know, apartment to start working through their, you know, prayers in that area, get together for, you know, events and festivities. But then they found out the issues with, you know, parking and, you know, many people attending in a place which is like a residential area. So that didn't work up that well. So in 2010, then, the people at that time, I was not present. I came about like six, seven years ago here. They then, you know, bought that community center from the Holy Redeemer Parish Church and then started working on that building, which was, you know, at that time in not a really good shape, but it required a lot of work. But eventually, it became a center and hub for the Muslim community to get together for their Friday congregations, for their, you know, festivities, the Eid events, for the Ramadan activities, for the student, the kids to get together on Sundays and have some, you know, education. And gradually, things improved from there.
When a new place of worship was required, the community took it upon themselves to pool their resources to make it happen, just as the Jewish community and Black community did many years ago.
What my understanding is that the fundraising was done locally and solely within the Cape Breton. The profile of the community at that time, and almost the same as currently as well, is mainly the health professionals who were hired by the, you know, Cape Breton Hospital, and they established themselves there. So they were you know, confident enough to acquire, you know, enough money amongst those people and, you know, stimulate them to, you know, for this cause. So they got that money through the local efforts, mainly through those local efforts. But the issue remains that to find an appropriate place where there is not a, you know, a problem with the parking, because, you know, at times there will be many more people than a normal, you know, street parking can afford or normal parking space can afford. So then they ended up finding it. So that the decision to make that probably took long time to come to a decision in that 2 years of, you know, effort to get a place. And once they were agreed on that, I think then it will become easy.
The makeup of the Cape Breton Muslim Society's congregation reflects the face of Cape Breton, professionals and students alike.
The makeup of the community remains almost the same, as a good proportion of them, major proportion are the doctors, the health professionals who have done their medical training in different places, and they have come after, you know, some training in Canada and ended up and decided to live in Cape Breton. That's the main group of people. And Dr. You know, the president who at the time of the acquisition of that property, Dr. Atiyah, is a plastic surgeon, the only plastic surgeon in our community, in the whole Cape Breton Island, actually. So that's the main portion. Then we have a few teachers. Some are working in Cape Breton University, some in the Coast Guard College, and that also constitute a sizable group. Then we have people who are, you know, on a variety of professions. Then there's some engineers, some businessmen doing their own businesses. And lately we have a good proportion of students from different countries like Bangladesh and India who finished their, you know, studentship and training, and then they ended up doing into some different jobs within the, you know, island. And then after these 40 to 50 people, families, which constitute of this, you know, group, you know, different professions, we always have some students and an incentive to, you know, for those students to come into the community. About 5-6 years ago, or I would say at the time when the mosque was done, bought up, at that time there was a huge influx of Saudi students. So there were at time up to 1,000 to 2,000 students who were there. And this was a major group of people who were attending the congregations at that time because of their number. But gradually their contracts ended, the government contracts, and then they mostly are gone. A few of them are left. And now there's a huge influx of Indian students, you know, after the, some Chinese. And India has a big population of Muslim students, so we ended up getting a good number of Muslims from those, you know, student, you know, who are coming here. And they also, you know, come into the community and participate in activities.
For Dr. Raza, Cape Breton has become home.
So I was born in Pakistan, and I did my medical college there, medical school there, and then I went for my training in UK, and I spent about 10 years in UK and got trained in my profession, and then I decided to come for some advanced training in Toronto, in the University Hospital Network in Toronto, and while doing the training there, found an opportunity to visit Cape Breton and see the community and see the hospital. So when I came, the mosque was, I think, was acquired for about 2 years or so. So I came in 2011-12 time, so there was very early phase of the mosque. But having seen a mosque in the community and a potential for the place, you know, a big place and the community, I thought that's a good place to, you know, settle down, and found the people and heard about the good nature of the people, the welcoming nature. So I decided to come, and I came in July 2012, and going strong since then.
Cape Breton's natural beauty and its people are why Dr. Raza loves it here.
Cape Breton is a nice place. I mean, it's has this beauty of, from the outside, you know, the famous Cabot Trail and all that. But for me and many of the people who I speak in the community, what they feel, you know, most, you know, attractive about the place is the, you know, like the, you know, the quality of life is great and the people are welcoming, you know, the quality of people and their welcoming nature and their, you know, ability to accept, you know, other people of other culture. I found that that's pretty remarkable. You know, their empathy in the times of difficulty and being happy in the times of, you know, your happiness. That's pretty remarkable. I found the religious community here, you know, the different churches and other places who came together at the time of atrocities and, you know, difficulties that's, you know, recently happened and before in Quebec. That was really, very inspiring at the time of difficulties. You know, at the time of the Quebec event, there was multi-faith events, you know, condolence events, you know, when people came together just for, you know, remember those people. And these were not organized by just ourselves, were organized by the other faith communities. So on the faith side, there is a welcoming attitude, an attitude of working together, not opposing each other. On a more neutral side, people are generally just are welcoming and, you know, more acceptable in accepting of the presence of a different kind of people with a different cultural background in amongst themselves.
Right.
The congregants at the Cape Breton Muslim Society reflect the diversity in the Islamic faith itself. Islam is a major world religion, practiced in many nations around the globe.
It is a worldwide religion, and it's truly reflect in our community as well. We have, in such a small place and such a small group of people, we have, you know, like people from different ethnicities, nationality, up to like 10, 12 different nationalities in this small group of people who represent Islam as their religion. You know, we have, you know, people with, you know, Canadian, you know, white background, people with, you know, African heritage, people from Africa, from Arab countries, from, you know, South Asia, even China. So it's a pretty heterogeneous mix.
The people of Cape Breton have been mostly welcoming to their new neighbors.
In our experience, people are pretty accommodating and the understanding of the faith. We personally have no problem interacting with people, you know, in a professional manner, for sure. People are so friendly, they just, you know, feel you know, a sense of thankfulness as well that people are here to serve us as well. You know, many of us are in service jobs, so that is always there. Even in a, you know, neutral, non-service interaction with people, there is always a friendly atmosphere. You know, and I can't recall any, you know, major event where I felt, you know, insulted by someone or any sort of thing like that. So community is, you know, in simple words, are, you know, pretty accommodating.
The parallels in all three of these communities are striking. The people arrive, then muster their resources to create a space for themselves. Their children grow and become some of our most prominent citizens, and make contributions to our culture that become part of Cape Breton's very identity. The story of Cape Breton's houses of worship are, in fact, the story of Cape Breton itself. A special thanks to Marty Chernin, Stephen Nathanson, Deacon Whitfield Best, and Dr. Arsalan Raza for sharing their stories this week. On the next episode of The Story of Home, we'll learn how Cape Breton has become classroom to the world and meet some of the international students who've come here to learn.
Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. We would like to thank the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Radio Meters program for its financial support of this series.